This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
4000. Again, that's 713-526-4000. This is 9.1 KPFT, Houston's only listener-sponsored radio station.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Walensky.
And Jennifer Renee.
J.D. Doyle.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And on tonight's show, we actually have a lot of stuff that sounds really interesting. First up, the Bearings and Friends production. We're actually going to have some live music.
Yes.
Okay.
They're bringing in the piano even as we speak.
Yes. Well, at least they're not taking it out or repossessing things like they used to in the old days. And second up, Deborah?
That's going to be Sam Gutierrez talking with Greg Chapman about the RC process, the theory behind it, and why it's good to know about in the GLBT community, and that the people in the recovery community are also very affirming of GLBT persons.
And in the second hour, we're going to talk about a longtime friend of this community. Jack Jackson passed away just the other day, and Jack Jackson was a longtime supporter of many organizations, especially the Montrose Counseling Center, and in a memorial talking about the great things that he did for many, many years in this community.
And plus, we'll have commentary, news brief, and, of course, J.D.
Music.
Music, of course. So all that's coming up on this edition of Queer Voices. And I guess we just sort of talk about a few things going on in the community right now.
Well, first we're going to go to a news wrap from This Way Out, if we're ready, if it's queued up to go. No?
Not quite.
Well, what is going on in the community?
Well, Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at
Ready at
3400 Montrose, Suite 207, is the Houston GLBT Political Caucus General Meeting, where the endorsements will be voted on.
Okay, it's the General Meeting and the PAC.
Yes.
Endorsements.
Yes, the PAC endorsements.
Has to be a separate thing.
I understand. actually, the General Meeting
is about to... So we have some new people to announce that the caucus will be supporting for this November election.
Yes.
Okay.
This is where the actual decisions will be made.
So get there. You don't have to be a member to attend, but you can join, and then later you become a you earn your voting ship.
As a matter of fact, those that membership. Might be interested, come and see how democracy works in our community.
And tomorrow, Ray Hill is doing a preview, sort of a reading of his new show.
Oh, where's that going to be?
The community center at 6:30.
What's his new show called?
You know, I don't even know.
I think it's the one where he's a teenage evangelist.
Yes,
I think it is. That's what he talked about.
That's scary. Yeah.
Well, he was.
He was a lot of things.
Yes.
He was a lot of, that was one of them.
It's a lot of plays.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to go to that, KPFT is actually having a KPFA on the air movie tomorrow, August 1st, at Tracy G. Community Center, which is at 3599 West Center Drive, just north of West Park, almost to the Beltway. And that's at 7 p.m. Actually, that sounds interesting, but I'm going to go see Ray's show.
And also tomorrow night is National Night Out, so if you want, get together with some of your neighbors and
go out with somebody.
Yeah, go out with somebody. Get out there and make sure our neighborhoods stay safe, because that's one thing Ray says. One of the best security devices is nosy neighbors.
Yeah, well, being out there, being involved with your neighborhood, knowing what's going on, and very few people really are.
Yeah, and knowing who you can turn to for help if you need it, or if there's elderly people in your neighborhood that might need help at when we have a disaster or whatever, it's useful to know.
All right, I believe we're ready. No, we're not.
No, he's still shaking his head. He's like, I'm working on it as fast as I can.
We're going to go to music.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah, I'm afraid the computer is crawling like an anemic dog.
It must be related to my computer, because that's the kind of day I had. I had all kinds of computer problems.
Well, let's make an executive's decision here. We go to music, and then we come back with our first live interview.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
It sounds good to Glenn. That's good enough for me.
Are we going to do this by consensus, or are we going to vote on it?
Well,
it doesn't matter.
Point of order.
Should I intro it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know what it is?
Yes, I do.
Well, then by all means.
I brought a song by Sonya, one of my favorites, and the song's very appropriate regarding the news lately. It's called No Bomb Is Smart.
No bombs are smart, and war is not the answer. Well, it seems like Mercury is retrograde, or the moon is void of course, or something. It's not a full moon, I know that, but I had computer problems all day today, and trying to get the schedule together and figure it all out and get the rundown sheet from This Way Out proved to be problematic. And so we have readjusted the schedule even as we're getting in the studio. So we will have this way, news wrap from This Way Out later. But first up, we're going to be talking to Les Wood, who is director of the Baring and Friends production of Once Upon a Time, which will be at the Alley on August 11th and 12th. And also my dear friend Daniel Garces, who is the director of the Baring Support Network. Is that right? The right title?
That's correct.
All right. I'm doing well. And then we have these other really good-looking guys over here. you want to introduce yourselves?
My name's Jonathan McVeigh.
And Andrew Alegria.
And over there on piano?
Rob Seibel.
And tell me a little bit about what Baring and Friends is.
Well, this is our 13th year, our 13th production for Baring and Friends, and its sole purpose is to do musical theater, to raise funds to support the Baring Support Network.
And so that leads us to a little bit about what's the Baring Support Network and why should we be supporting it?
Well, the Baring Support Network's been around for about 18 years now in some form or function, and we started off working with HIV support groups and have now grown to include depression, bipolar support groups, and other groups such as Fathers First and the Sisters that we support. So we really do a lot of support groups for the community in addition to doing very affordable individual, couple, and family therapy.
And you also have a youth group, right?
We have a new youth group called Project Excite for GLBT and questioning youth, and we'd like to see that grow as it's continued to grow, yeah. So we're really excited by that.
So, Baring and Friends, I mean, that's a bunch of friends, and they get together and they hang out?
well, something like that, I think, right, Les? I guess Les would know more about that than I, but I think many people from the church who donate their time and their talents, and a fair number, a growing number of people, I think, from the community.
Right. We always pull in some new people from the community. It started, hey, let's get together and do a show, and so let's go out in the barn and put on a production,
right?
And it's become a tradition, certainly in the community, in the Baring community and beyond, and it's taken on a life of its own. And so now we have a number of varying levels of talent. We have people who are professional singers and actors and musicians, and people who just do this because they love it and because they appreciate the cause we're working for.
So what you do every year is put together a production. It's always a musical?
It's always a musical.
And different people lend their talents to it. And
right.
As you said, some are professional and some are not. Some are members of the Baring Memorial Methodist Church congregation and some are not.
Right.
And when does the effort to start putting the production together start?
Well, it's pretty much year-round. It takes a lot of planning to get something like this off the ground and to secure the venue. We're so excited this year that we've secured the Alley Theater for the first time.
Yeah.
So
has it been before?
It was in theaters for the first 8 or 10 years of its life. The last 4 years we've done it actually in the sanctuary at Baring Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And as you might imagine, putting a sanctuary together to become a theater is very labor intensive. So we're excited about moving into a space that's made for theater,
yeah.
Once again.
And this will be the large stage at the Alley?
This will be the downstairs small stage.
Okay, the knee house
right.
stage.
Right.
Okay, that's good to know. And that's a wonderful space though because it's in the round.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And
lots of interaction with the audience that way.
Uh-huh. And in the past, has the production been two nights?
It has varied greatly. We've done it over multiple weekends in the past. Sometimes it's been three nights in one weekend. And this year, we just decided to go with the Friday-Saturday lineup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it starts at what time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Well, since we have these wonderful, talented people here and the piano, why don't we have a little bit taste of one of the numbers?
Terrific. This is going to be Jonathan McVeigh, who plays the character of King George in the third act of the show. And I'll let him introduce it in his own way.
Don't understand why those rulers in those other countries don't give me the respect I deserve. They misunderestimate me. I read the newspaper. I glance at the headlines just to kind of get a flavor. To think that I don't know what's going on is just a myth. Though I rarely read the stories, I get briefed forthwith. I'm the little lie. As I stated in my state of the my State of the Union, or my state, my speech to the kingdom, I ask citizens to give 4,000 years, 4,000 hours over the next, the rest of your life of service to the kingdom. That's what I asked, 4,000 hours. I don't think we need to be subliminable about the differences between our views. This is still a dangerous world. It's a world of madmen and uncertainty and potential mental losses. In my judgment, when I say there will be serious consequences, and if there isn't serious consequences, it creates adverse consequences. Rarely is the question asked, is our children learning? Though it's true that reading is the basics for all learning. As King I've read, I understand about reality. Literate and hopefuler is what we want to be. Oh, they misunderestimate, I know what I believe. And I will keep articulating just what I believe. Now what I believe, I'll now recite. For the record, I believe what I believe is right.
King George, and I think we all know who that was referring to, if only it were a fairy tale. Now,
lyrics, of course, written somewhat inadvertently by George W. Bush.
Yes, isn't that interesting how that worked out? Once upon a time, fairy tales with a grown-up twist. So what are some of the plot lines, some of the fairy tales that are covered?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's in three acts. So we take three children's stories and very loosely translate them. The first one is the story based on the princess and the pea, which in our case is the princess and the brie. The second is based on any amalgamation of several transformation stories, like Cinderella or the Swan, the Ugly Duckling, things like that, a character transformation. And it's simply called Transformation. It's about a young man dealing with self-esteem issues. And he's assisted by his fairy god coach.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third, of course, we just heard a snippet from, is King George's Spectacular Treasure, which is a take on The Emperor's New Clothes.
I was suspicious that that might be what it would be about. Indeed it is. So the princesses and the brie?
The princess and the brie.
Princes and the brie. What does that look like? What happens in that?
Well, there is a prince who is ready to take over the throne, except that his mother, the very domineering queen, has decreed that...
I wouldn't know anything about domineering queens.
Well, we know none of those. He cannot assume the throne until he is married. But in order to be married, he has to pass a test of his mother's choosing. So we have a suitor who comes to the kingdom, and the test is presented. And, of course, I can't tell you too much. That would give away the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, the whole production. And it will be at the Alley Theater at 615 Texas Avenue in Houston, Friday, August 11th, and Saturday, August 12th at 8 p.m. And for information and tickets, you can visit www.baringandfriends.org. And are there other places to get tickets, or you just order them online is the only way?
That website is your best bet. It gives you information. It has places if you would like to support the show through underwriting. Our online auction is there for the event, and so we recommend that people just go ahead and visit the website and order their tickets there. It's the easiest way.
Okay, an online auction. This is
right.
New information.
Yeah, right.
So does this auction take place at the event as well?
It does. It turns live on the evening of the event.
Okay, and you've got some wonderful goodies that people can check out. And
we do. And there's also...
They're not going to want to miss this because...
Absolutely, and there are also opportunities to donate to the auction. That website.
Okay, so that's the 411 on that. And are we going to be graced with another little number?
Andrew Alegria, who plays the young prince who is dying to be wed, is going to sing "I Have Dreamed."
what joy you'll be. I have dreamed every word you whisper when you're close, close to me. How you looked in the glow of evening. I have dreamed and enjoyed.
Lovely. And what segment is that from?
That's from The Princes and the Bree.
I see. The young prince. Oh, my gosh.
Prince Elwin's
pining for his true love. I can tell. So, is there anything else we need to know about Baring and Friends and this production?
Well, you know, Baring and Friends is our largest fundraising effort for the Baring Support Network, and we're very pleased to have a very talented and dedicated cast and crew, and every year we're just amazed how they grow and continue to stretch their creativity and their commitment to us, and so we're very appreciative of that. We could not do it without them. And as Les had indicated, we are having the silent auction. People can go to baringandfriends.org now and bid on items. And again, we're just rolled over by the generosity of the community. I mean, many, many community members and businesses are so supportive of us and provided us wonderful items for that. So we're very grateful to them as well and are just looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and certainly I think we keep growing. And this year, with it being the Alley Theater, I think it's just going to be even more so. So we're really looking forward to it and hope people will come out and attend.
So you can support Baring and Friends, Once Upon a Time, Fairy Tales with a Grown-Up Twist at the Alley Theater on August the 11th and August 12th at 8 p.m. Thank you, Daniel, Les, and you wonderful, talented people for being with us tonight on Queer Voices.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 29, 2006. The Baltic nation of Slovenia has granted legal recognition to registered same-gender partners, but with significant restrictions. The new law gives gay and lesbian couples access to each other's pensions and property, but inexplicably limits those at the official ceremonies to the couple and a local registry official. Slovenia's gay and lesbian organizations, while welcoming the move, criticize the law as insufficient because no friends or family can attend the ceremonies, and they may only be conducted in a state office. Lesbian and gay couples must register 30 days in advance and provide documents proving they are sane, healthy, and unmarried. In early July, the Czech Republic became the first country in the region to legalize much less restrictive gay and lesbian civil partnerships.
But Washington's Supreme Court this week dealt U.S. marriage equality advocates another setback. The state legislature passed its version of the Defense of Marriage Act in 1998, restricting marriage to one man and one woman. Two lawsuits were filed by a total of 19 gay and lesbian couples challenging the constitutionality of the law. Overturning lower court decisions in each of those cases, the Washington High Court ruled 5-4 that only the legislature could change the state's marriage laws. In his concurring opinion, Justice James Johnson wrote that the challenge by marriage equality backers involved a claim of raw judicial power to redefine public institutions such as marriage. This court does not possess that power. No court does. The majority opinion also echoed recent rulings by other state high courts that bearing and raising children is an important reason to keep marriage an exclusively heterosexual institution. But the main dissenting opinion, written by Justice Mary Fairhurst, criticized her colleagues for ignoring the fact that denying same-sex couples the right to marry has no prospect of furthering any of those interests. nor of any of the recent high court rulings citing the state's need to encourage heterosexual matrimony, most notably in New York and Georgia, acknowledge the existence of thousands of same-gender couples and their children. The narrow 5-4 decision, issued 16 months after the court heard oral arguments, generated pages of competing opinions. Because only three justices agreed with the specific rationale of the ruling, it's a plurality opinion, given less weight than if a full majority had signed on. Two other justices agreed that the state's Defense of Marriage Act was constitutional, but issued separate opinions to explain their reasoning. Even the majority ruling acknowledged the discrimination faced by same-gender couples and said that the legislature should address those inequities. Openly gay Washington State Representative Jim Moeller vowed this week to do just that, saying he'll introduce a bill in the next legislative session to open marriage to same-gender couples. The Democrat-controlled California legislature last year became the only U.S. state lawmaking body to pass a marriage equality bill, but Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it.
The next judicial walk down the matrimonial aisle appears to be in Maryland's highest court. A Baltimore circuit judge ruled in January that the state's ban on same-gender marriage is unconstitutional. The Maryland Court of Appeals agreed this week to fast-track to its next term a constitutional challenge to the law, originally filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and Equality Maryland on behalf of 9 same-gender couples. Oral arguments before the Court of Appeals are expected to be heard in December. No one would predict when the Maryland High Court might issue a ruling.
Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union announced this week that they filed papers asking the full federal 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to reconsider its 3-judge panel's decision upholding a particularly onerous Nebraska statute. The July 14th ruling said that the voter-approved state constitutional amendment banning any form of legal recognition for lesbian and gay couples does not violate the U.S. Constitution. There were no predictions as to if, when, or how the Eighth Circuit would respond to the appeal.
A challenge to the notion that marriage equality should be the priority issue for queer advocacy groups is being widely circulated and discussed across America. A statement titled Beyond Same-Sex Marriage, A New Strategic Vision for All Our Families and Relationships, asserts that advocacy for other important issues affecting gays and lesbians has been overwhelmed by the time and dollars spent on marriage equality and ignores many in the community for whom marriage is not a direct concern. Among the 250 original signatories are current and former leaders of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, novelist Armistead Maupin, and heterosexual allies like scholar Cornel West, Ms. Magazine founder Gloria Steinem, and essayist Barbara Ehrenreich. The timing of its release, during the same week that the task force, GLAAD, and Freedom to Marry launched a $250,000 nationwide Marriage Matters newspaper ad campaign, was coincidental, according to Joseph DeFilippis of Queers for Economic Justice and a co-author of the statement. He told reporters that resources spent on marriage dwarf what's spent on other important issues, such as domestic partnership and universal health care. But Lambda Legal's John Davidson said he doubted that the circulating statement would create a serious divide in the LGBT community. I think the press attention is definitely focused disproportionately on marriage, he said, but most organizations and many members of our community are not. DeFilippis claimed that the number of signatories at beyondmarriage.org more than doubled in the first week it was posted, suggesting growing support for a greater advocacy on a wider slate of LGBT issues.
With the backing of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, a decorated Army sergeant and Arabic language specialist is speaking out about his discharge under the infamous Don't Ask, Don't Tell U.S. military policy. 30-year-old Blue Kopas told the Associated Press this week that he was outed earlier this year by several anonymous emails to his superiors in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Kopas says his honorable discharge papers, which mention his awards and citations, also give the reason for his dismissal, outing him to prospective employers before they've even had the chance to meet him. He plans to appeal to the Army Board for Correction of Military Records. More than 11,000 lesbian and gay service members have been dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell since its inception in 1993. The Federal General Accountability Office reported that nearly 800 of them have had critical skills, including 300 linguists. 55 were proficient in Arabic, including Kopas, a graduate of the Defense Language Institute. According to the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military at the University of California, Santa Barbara, discharging and replacing those service members has cost the Pentagon nearly $369 million.
A federal judge this week dismissed a challenge to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy brought by a veteran Air Force nurse who was forced out of her job because she's a lesbian. Air Force Reserve Major Margaret Witt of Spokane, Washington, asked U.S. District Judge Ronald B. Layton to reinstate her, citing the 2003 U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down all state sodomy laws. Layton ruled that the decision didn't affect the constitutionality of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Witt is a 19-year Air Force veteran who'd been assigned to a medical evacuation squadron working out of McCord Air Force Base near Tacoma. She was suspended without pay in late 2004 after the Air Force received an apparently anonymous tip that she had been in a long-term relationship with a civilian woman. Her official discharge is still pending. Doug Honig of the American Civil Liberties Union said they plan to appeal Witt's case to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Major Witt is much decorated and has saved people's lives, he told reporters. The people she helped didn't care about her sexual orientation.
It apparently requires other than U.S. citizenship and knighthood to overcome the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. British gay actor and outspoken activist Sir Ian McKellen has been made an officer in the Georgia National Guard by Republican Governor Sonny Perdue. Although Perdue supports the anti-queer military policy and has been an outspoken opponent of marriage equality, his staff was apparently ignorant of McKellen's sexual orientation. I was in Atlanta doing press for the Da Vinci Code, and they wanted to honor me, Sir Ian told the New York Daily News, boasting, "The governor made me a lieutenant colonel."
And finally, unless you've been sequestered somewhere, you probably know that a boy band heartthrob has said bye 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 to the closet in a big way. Lance Bass of the hit-making NSYNC came out in a splashy cover story this week in People magazine. The singer said he's been reluctant to be more open about his sexual orientation because he feared it might affect the success of NSYNC, which has been on hiatus since 2003, and that he felt responsible for the careers of his bandmates as well as his own. Bass says he's in a very stable relationship with Ryken Lemkuhl, a co-winner of the CBS TV reality show The Amazing Race a few seasons back. The thing is, I'm not ashamed. That's the one thing I want to say, he told the magazine. I'm more liberated and happy than I've been my whole life. Bye, bye, bye.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 29th, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
This is Queer Voices.
Hello, this is Greg Chapman, and with me is
Jennifer Renee.
And with us tonight is Sam Gutierrez. He is a lawyer by day, and by night he is an instructor in the discharge process. And Sam is here tonight to talk about that and why it's an important tool or useful tool for improving our lives and for gaining clarity about who we are and where we want to go.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. So Sam, I'm sure most of our listeners aren't really familiar with the discharge process and what it is. What's a good way to describe it?
Well, let me start first by just telling you that there, what we're talking about is just they're the origin of troubles, the origin of emotional and physical hurts that we encounter from a very early age. And the healing process in human beings is quite natural and spontaneous. If we were given the opportunity, especially as young people, we try to take advantage of that opportunity but aren't always allowed it. If we were given the opportunity, we would naturally and spontaneously try to heal ourselves from these physical and emotional hurts that occur every day. And
of course, men especially have, I guess both men and women have different different issues there. For men, they're not supposed to cry.
Absolutely.
Women aren't supposed to be angry.
Right. It starts very early on. What happens is girls, females, are given more latitude in terms of showing and accessing their emotions. Boys typically are allowed some at a very early age, and then it stops. And, you know, some of the most common phrases are, big boys don't cry, I'll give you something to cry about, threats and intimidation, whatever, to shut down. Because people misunderstand.
You're quoting my father.
Right. People misunderstand that if you're crying or if you're angry or if you're shivering or because of fear or whatever, that somehow you're hurting, that is the hurt itself. They don't realize that those are just the physical manifestations of releasing the stored emotional and physical tension that's associated with the harmful or hurtful event. So children try continuously to heal themselves from this, and at an early age it begins to get shut down. It gets shut down in boys much sooner than it does in girls. And so laughter, for example, is one of the ways in which we can release physical and emotional tension. And that's very acceptable by society. All right. If you laugh too long, too loud, then there's something maybe that's a little kind of off about you or something like that. Certainly crying is a permissible one to a certain extent. And I'll give you an example. The loss of a loved one. You will be allowed to mourn and grieve the loss of a loved one. And then at some point in time, you know, a few weeks, a month, then people start to get worried that something is wrong, that there is some kind of, that you're, you know, this is taking too long, this is, you're carrying this out too far or whatever.
Okay. And even if you're given the latitude, a lot of people have trouble actually crying at first.
Absolutely, because it's been shut down very early age. You know, one of the most common things you hear is that men don't ever show their emotions. All right, so you're talking to a 30, 40, 50-year-old man who hasn't been allowed to show any emotions up past the age of 5, 6, or 8. I mean, you can understand why it's not an impossibility. It's just they've not been allowed to in the past, and so it's much more difficult to access that now. And so if you were allowed to early on, you would have continued to do it, and current day upsets would not be a big deal.
And I guess the problem is that if you've got all this stored tension, all these upsets, these wounds, whatever it is, it's all bottled up inside of you, it would have to muddle your thinking.
Absolutely. It affects our thinking, and it also, what it does is it reinforces rigid codes of behavior. We learn early on to act a certain way, and we get messages to act a certain way. And so as these hurts, when we continue to get hurt, they sort of form like layers on top of the old hurts. And what happens is a current day hurt looks, smells, tastes, feels, sounds like something that's happened in the past. It's actually sort of like a reenactment of the old hurt. So you have now formed a rigid response, and you're no longer thinking clearly. You're just you're responding the way you have learned to respond to that situation, even though the current situation is really no threat and has nothing to do with what the old hurt was.
So are we talking about, when you say hurt, are we talking about something physical, or are we talking about something emotional?
It's both.
It's both.
Both physical and emotional. One example would just be if you had surgery.
Okay.
You know, and if you're
been there, done that.
And you do anesthesia, and you're not allowed to, you know, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of effect on your body, and your body has not been allowed to heal that from that. So there are lasting effects from that type of a trauma. Any incident, whether even if it doesn't involve a physical component to it, the emotional component in and of itself will leave a lasting hurt. And you can try to recover that. The sooner you try to do that, that lasting hurt won't last as long as...
What do we do about it?
Well, one of the things you do is you can learn ways in which to access your emotions, ways to learn to identify what those issues are, where those physical hurts or where those emotional hurts are. And once you do that, with some time and attention, and primarily what that consists of is actually having somebody listen to you non-judgmentally, giving you no advice, paying good attention to you, no criticism. If you've ever noticed,
I've never met an angel before.
You right. People are always looking for somebody to listen to them. And if you give somebody that attention uninterrupted, they will access the discharge process themselves. They will begin to tell their story. They will cry. They will shiver. They will tremble. They will. These are physical manifestations of the release of tension and storage, release of tension. And if they can do that, they can. You can do that with some attention.
And you know, a common response when someone does that is to go up to them and say, "They're there," and kind of pat them on the back. To me, that's kind of trying to stop them from doing that.
Well, it's making the person uncomfortable. That's why don't cry. It's okay, because that's to make us feel better, not the person that's
absolutely
crying.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So if you can learn some techniques where, one, you understand that those physical manifestations, such as crying, is actually part of the healing process. It's not part of the hurting process. Society believes, mistakenly, again, that that is part of the hurting process, and if I can get you to stop crying, you're not going to be hurting anymore. Mm. So if you get someone who understands that it's part of the healing process and not the hurt, then I would allow you to cry and encourage you to cry, or encourage you to express one of the other physical manifestations that we've talked about, and until such a time that then you have worked through the process, you've worked through that, and you regain some clarity in thinking about that particular hurt.
How does laughter work then? I mean, we're talking about crying and cleansing, but how does laughter?
Laughter is just another form, another physical manifestation. All laughter, even that's why we like jokes, comedians so much. And sometimes you'll notice that you'll laugh really, really hard, and you'll work yourself into a perspiration, or you'll start crying. You know, you're laughing so hard, kind of thing. That is the release of tension. And what's happened is that somehow the comedian has struck a chord, has somehow allowed some safety, and you're able to look at something that's happened to you in some way that somehow is connected to what the comedian is talking about, that allows you to release that tension. And that's good.
So sometimes that nervous laughter when we're sitting in a situation or a comedian and we have sort of, there's always that one time that a little nervous laughter goes through the crowd. It sort of hit a chord with everyone.
Yes.
They're holding back because they don't have permission to go in and let it
out. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I would say safety is like a huge thing. We only discharge as much as we feel safe to do so.
Right. And we're not allowed to, so it's not very safe generally in society. So we do hold back, or we completely shut down and don't ever allow it. And you hear people say all the time, "Well, I just can't express any emotion. I just can't do that. You know, I'm just not built that way," or whatever. And that's not true. Everyone, this is a natural process. It's inherent. It's spontaneous. And everyone can just reclaim that if they're given the opportunity to do that.
So if you have someone in the GLBT community, and there's certainly a lot of hurt and
women
in the GLBT community, and let's say one particular issue that someone has is their parents just, they refuse to give them any love, and there's obviously a lot of deep hurt about that, and they were doing a one-on-one session with you. What would be maybe would there be like certain techniques that you could use that
Absolutely.
Would help? Would help that person release?
Yeah, you would have to understand how the gay oppression sits and why this particular person endured the kind of hurt, which is the loss of his parental love and affection, alienation of his affection, something like that. So, what I would do with this particular person, from what you just described, the first thing is to allow him a period of time, or her a period of time, to grieve over the loss of that. That is a real and that is a real loss for somebody in the GLB community, is to have become disenfranchised from their family or being rejected or not accepted or whatever. So that's like a very good example. So there would be a time period for grief about just not having that, about that loss. And then it would move on. It would eventually become angry. They would become indignant. How dare my parents not love me or whatever? I mean, you know, because justifiably, you should be indignant about somebody withdrawing their love or intentions. Eventually, you would go through the cycle of the physical manifestations that we just, you know, that we describe. And eventually, you would get to a point where you would be able to think clearly about the way, in this particular example, the way things sit with your parents that make them do and say the things that they do, and you would sit here with the realization that I am still a good person, I am still lovable, and that it's not a reflection of
who I am.
Right.
I wouldn't reject, because I guess what happens a lot is you end up rejecting yourself.
Absolutely.
Because someone else rejected you. You take that in.
Correct.
Right. Well, that's really interesting.
So if you're allowed the opportunity and in a session, that's what I would do with somebody, and then they would get to the realization that they're a lovable person, that they're good, that they've done nothing wrong.
And is it just a matter of understanding the parents and their side of it, that they're just shut down? Is that what we're trying to get to?
Yeah, that's
I'm talking about our healing. It's a matter of realization that they're just shut down. They're not going to. They're incapable of showing that kind of feeling and love.
That's a very big component, but that understanding that in and of itself still doesn't allow you to heal from the hurt that you did experience, which was a legitimate hurt, you know, the loss or the withdrawal or the rejection. And so it's sort of a double component. The first thing is just to be aware of why it's happened and how it's happened and why they can't do what you would like for them to do. And then but the more important thing is that you actually get to grieve the loss for yourself of whatever that means to you.
Okay, because what you were discussing, and as Greg was suggesting, you know, my parents have passed away, but my siblings, you know, as soon as I told them what I was intending to do and all, I haven't had any real contact with them. They have just sort of isolated themselves from me, and so that's why I was asking. And I know I face that feeling of loss on a regular basis, birthdays and that sort of stuff. So.
Right.
I understand. I'm trying to put my arms around what it is I should do.
What you would do is you would start with yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And for example, you would talk about what those losses mean to you and what it has meant to you, and that's where you would start with yourself. As you begin to heal from that by going through this time period where you're spending time kind of focused on that issue and one-on-one with somebody who's willing to listen to you and to provide you attention that you would need in order to be able to process all that, then eventually you'll be able to start thinking a little bit more clearly about your siblings or your parents or whomever it is that has caused this hurt. And then you have what you would become just a different objective viewpoint. You would just be coming from a different place and begin better understand them. Okay. It doesn't mean that doesn't necessarily mean that you would have to do anything different. It's just that you would be in a better place for it. Or it may mean that then you might have some better, clear ideas about how to approach them the next time you see them, as opposed to replaying all of the old stuff that's always replaying whenever you do see them.
And that's a good example. I mean, I know like when I had a lot of anger when my mother rejected me for being gay, and when we would get together, it would almost always turn into a fight.
Absolutely.
I mean, she knew how to push my buttons, and I just couldn't help myself. I would just, even though I knew that's what she was doing, I was so angry inside, I just went right with it, and we ended up fighting every time.
And that's a classic example. She, just as much as you, is always looking for a place to heal themselves. She is using that opportunity and encountering you to bring up this hurt for herself. She doesn't have to do it with you. She gets to go and have this, do the same thing with somebody else and talk about her loss in finding out about you and what that meant to her and everything else. So the both of y'all, you're replaying this recording, and it doesn't ever change because there's no discharge going on. You're not being allowed to heal naturally and spontaneously because the tape recorder comes on and you just reenact what you always reenact because that's the standard response that you have with one another. Even though what you're both trying to do is to clear this up. You're looking, but you don't have the time and the attention for each other because it's too much of a hot button issue. So you would need to go to your corner and work through this process. She needs to go to her corner and work through that process, and maybe at a later time, then it wouldn't be such a hot button, and then y'all might be able to interact in a different way.
And I guess if only one of us goes to the corner and goes through that process, I suppose it could still be that you get together and maybe the mother still tries to push her buttons, but hopefully it wouldn't.
The buttons won't be there.
Yeah, the buttons, for me, wouldn't be there. Right. I wouldn't be responding to them in the same way.
And you would be responding to her in a fresh, new way from a different perspective. And so you would no longer be in that mode of just replaying the recording, and then you might start thinking more intelligently, let's say, or more clearly about how to engage her differently than the way she's responding.
That's really cool. You know, just to make sure that we get the information out, if anyone is interested in hearing about this, what is some contact information?
They can. There are several people in Houston who would be willing to talk with anyone about the process, about the techniques, and how to go about learning about this process. You can reach me at 713-524-2642. You can call Pam Geyer at 713-666-7300. And we'd be delighted to talk with anyone who wants more information.
Great. So I guess the ultimate end for this process is to sort of recover mental clarity?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about reclaiming, and it's about recovering your natural intelligence. We have a huge, vast intelligence, and we should be able to, in any situation, come up with a clear and fresh response to any situation that's different from any other. In other words, we don't have to press that recorder button every time. And so if the whole idea is that if we can free up our intelligence will take over and come up with fresh new responses.
And an appropriate response.
And appropriate responses, yeah. Absolutely.
I guess a question, something we've been talking about, the old hurts, you know, I think I brought up the suggestion, but what about on a day-to-day basis? Something that happens on every day, we get some kind of interactions that may be hurtful. I know in my own personal experience, there's always someone that you know, will say something behind your back, and it's
right.
Hurtful. What would you do then? Go call someone up, talk to them about it, that this person said something, or...
Right. You would use the opportunity for the current day situation. Because the current day situation, the current day event or incident is not the real issue. There is an older underlying issue. The current day event looks, smells, tastes, sounds, feels like something else that has happened in the past to you that brings up these feelings.
So it's a trigger to something
deeper.
It's an
absolute trigger.
So we go back to the beginning again,
right.
What we were talking about.
It's not to say that you don't get to talk about what somebody said to you today. I mean, that's where you start. But it really goes back to
the way maybe people have always treated you, or the way you perceive that people have always treated you, or the way you perceive that whatever. And it's like you said, it's a trigger for something much earlier. And the reason you would want to work on the earlier stuff is because I talked earlier about layers of hurt that kind of stack up on top of each other. And if you can go back and clarify some of the earlier stuff, then all of these other layers begin to tumble down. And so what would happen is that the next time somebody talked behind your back or you heard somebody say that, you might not have the same response. You would not... be sucked back into that old feeling of whatever hurt you
exactly.
experienced.
Okay, that makes good sense. And that's some practical use of, on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
They're very good.
Yeah.
And what I was thinking is actually that current event hurt would actually be very useful because your emotions are probably teed up. So maybe if you have a hard time normally accessing your anger or your sadness or whatever, but you had something happen to you with that immediacy, it'd be a lot easier for you to access it and then go back.
Right, absolutely. And you had suggested you would go and call somebody because you want somebody to listen to your story again.
Exactly.
And if you were allowed to heal, if you were allowed to do that as children, you know, then these hurts would never stack up. They would never grow. They would never, I mean, you would work through them, and then the next time it happened, you'd have a completely different and fresh approach to whatever happened.
Unfortunately, we weren't able to do that in our early lives.
Absolutely.
You know, unless we had an imaginary friend, and that really wasn't that successful.
Right.
So that's very interesting. This is fascinating. Very fascinating. Right. And it's some practical things for us to do. You know, talk with someone else, laugh about it, cry about it, but don't hold it in.
And
that's good sound advice anytime.
And it's something that everyone can do.
It says something, absolutely.
Right. I mean,
and we can all learn to be able to give that time and attention to somebody else. And what you do, it's a two-way street. So I give you that time and attention, you give me that time and attention.
And I think that's a real important point.
Right. I mean, you have to have another person to do this.
Right. So if you call up somebody and you need 10 minutes of their time, for them to listen to you, you give them 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
Now, give us those telephone numbers and everything again.
It's 713-524-2642 and 713-666-7300.
And the names?
The first number is for Sam Gutierrez, and the second number is for Pam Geyer.
Great. Well, we have been talking with Sam Gutierrez about the discharge process, and Jennifer Renee has been helping out. And if you want to hear more about it, I encourage you to call that number. I think it's very useful for everybody, and certainly the GLBT community has a lot of hurts, a lot of issues that they could they need attention for. And
This is J.D. Doyle, and that song was called Held Her. That was by Susan Souza, S-O-U-Z-A, from her debut album, Inside and Outside.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
The Night Listener is a movie thriller based on the novel by Armistead Maupin. His book was, in turn, based on the true story of a story that was not true. With preview clips, This Way Out's Steve Pride sorts the facts from the factitious with Maupin and star Robin Williams.
From the studios of WNYH in New York City, I'm Gabriel Noon, and this is Noon at Night. As a storyteller, I've spent years looting my life for fiction, like a magpie. I tend to steal the shiny stuff and discard the rest. The facts can always be altered when you're telling a story. But this time, I have to be careful. I'll lay out the events exactly as I remember them. I want you to believe this, after all. That'll be hard enough as it is. This one is called The Night Listener.
Based on the book by Armistead Maupin and starring Robin Williams, The Night Listener is a psychological thriller that revolves around a popular writer and late-night radio show host, Gabriel Noon. Numbed by a breakup with his lover, Jess, Gabriel develops an intense phone relationship with a young listener named Pete, who has written a harrowing memoir about sexual abuse and his battle with AIDS. But when troubling questions arise regarding the boy's identity, Gabriel must overcome his depression and set out on a journey to find the truth. The movie is based on the book. The book is based on a true story, sort of.
Back in 1992, I was sent the manuscript of a memoir written by a 14-year-old boy who had suffered terrible abuse at the hands of his parents.
Author Armistead Maupin.
He'd been sort of sold into sex slavery and had been rescued by a social worker, had run away from home, and the social worker rescued him, and she recognized him as this bright, intelligent soul. She encouraged him to start writing. In fact, Paul Manette, my friend down in Los Angeles, who died of AIDS about 10 years ago, was the first person to coax him to write. And the memoir was sent to me, and I struck up a phone friendship with him the same way Paul had, and was very impressed by his feistiness and his courage. And I believed at the time that he was going to be dying within a year. And so I tried to be as supportive as I could be when he would call, and then a sort of very natural friendship grew up out of it. It was like knowing someone really special. And it wasn't until 6 months into the relationship that Terry Anderson, who was my partner then, listened to the mother on the phone, the woman who had adopted the boy, and pointed out that their voices sounded strangely similar. And that thrust me into a mystery that I was living day to day. For 6 years, really, I had to split my head down the middle, halfway believing in this person, but preparing for the possibility that he might not be real.
Whether or not the boy was real or lived only in the imagination of an adult impostor, the book, A Rock in a Hard Place, One Boy's Triumphant Story, was published in 1993.
Paul Manette wrote the preface to A Rock and a Hard Place, and that book was written by Anthony Godby Johnson, who was the kid I was talking to. The afterword, by the way, was written by Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. So it came to me with the best possible credentials. I had really no reason to doubt it. When I called the publisher in New York, he said, hang on a second, I have to close the door. And when I expressed my doubts, I said, do you know anybody who's actually met him? He told me that he'd been through the same doubts himself, but that he was convinced of his existence. His words were, he's like God, he's someone you have to believe in. Well, I'm not someone who has to believe in God. I can find my God in other places. I was thrown into, you know, terrible doubt, really, about as to what the truth was. And I realized that the only way I could dig myself out of this mess was to write about it in a fictional way and examine it in that way. My partner, Terry Anderson, my ex-partner, Terry Anderson, a few years back discovered there was an actual pathology called factitious disorder in which people invent illnesses for themselves or for a child in order to gain sympathy. I don't know whether that's what happened in my instance because I couldn't begin to play shrink here, but it seems like a logical explanation. I can't just sort of shrug this off with a laugh and say, oh, another trick played on the literary establishment the way a lot of people did when J.T. Leroy was exposed as an invention, because this person actually spent hours on the phone feigning a near-death child who was about to die and draining the energy of, for instance, Paul Manette, who was close to death himself and eventually had to just say, please don't call me anymore, because he wasn't certain himself as to who this was on the phone, and he had to think about his own death.
The Night Listener stars Robin Williams, a longtime friend of Armistead Maupin.
Armistead Maupin sent me a copy of the script saying, this piece is based upon my novella. And he sent me a copy saying, I think you'd like it. And he said, I think it's a great character. And not really, you know, saying it's me, but, you know. And I read it and went, oh, it is very good, thank you. I mean, you just want me to read it to see if I could, or like, just see what happens. And it was fascinating. From the very first, I was like, it's a great piece and wanted to be part of it. And for me, it kind of bookends 1 hour photo in terms of being on the receiving end of that type of disturbed personality. Reading his novella combined with knowing Armistead for 30 years gives you a nice running start. And then the idea of, you know, extrapolating from that and in the past having strange people contact you and people who will be very nice with you in the moment if you deny what they say, they get, you know, like Tony, very kind of, they flip on you. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I didn't mean to scare you. And it's like, if you don't say exactly what they want to hear, it can be quite scary.
In The Night Listener, Gabriel Noon's boyfriend, Jess, has just left him, paralleling Armistead Maupin's own separation from his lover, Terry Anderson. Jess is played by Will & Grace alumnus Bobby Cannavale.
If you're going to have a boyfriend, that's a good one. You know, it's kind of like a younger De Niro, but, you know, and a good kisser. Hey, what can I say? Sexy guy, you know? It's my version of Brokeback Mountain. That's as close as I can go right now. Bobby, you know, is a good thing. It's a good thing. So I'm talking like Bob. It's a good thing.
So what does Armistead Maupin want the audience to take away from the film version of his novel?
I'm very proud of the fact, among other things, that this is the first time I can think of in which a major Hollywood star has played a central character who is gay, and his homosexuality is completely irrelevant. It's simply part of his identity. There may be exceptions. I've been trying to think of what they are, but I'm happy that we accomplished that. And I mostly want people to have a good time. I want them to be thrilled. I want them to understand how you can go to see a movie and be creeped out by it and be sitting on the edge of your seat without having to have a lot of loud noises and quick cuts and dismembered limbs.
And in the end, I'm not sure what really happened. But it is clear that Donna and I are more alike than not. Both of us afraid. Not wanting to be alone. Longing for a good listener. As for Pete, there's a line in The Velveteen Rabbit that reads, real isn't how you're made. It's the thing that happens to you. I'm Gabriel Noon. Good night.
This has been a conversation with author Armistead Maupin and actor Robin Williams. The Night Listener is a Miramax release starring Robin Williams, Toni Collette, Bobby Cannavale, Rory Culkin, and Sandra Oh. As always, you can find more info at prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Transamerica, Capote, Brokeback Mountain, and others made 2005 a memorable year for queer content movies. Hear copious clips and comments by the filmmakers in Steve Pride's wonderful half-hour review. Log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can own Pride on Screen 2005 and help keep this program on the air.
Listen to Queer Voices.
Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices. A lesbian outsider, an independent New Englander, and a dynamic duo star in this month's edition of The Audiophile.
Second grade, Billy Sims. Playing out by the jungle gym. All the boys laughed at him for some sort of speech impediment. And they knocked him down. And I pushed them off.
That song is called The Underdogs, and last month it won the Out Music Award for Out Song of the Year. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. The Underdogs is also the title of this latest album by Jen Foster.
Well, my new CD is called The Underdogs, and I wrote it as a tribute to the freaks that I grew up with, myself included, of course. I think the tone of the record is a bit dark and contemplative, but I always have a message of hope in my song. I really wanted to reach out to the outsider in all of us, I guess, and remind people that everyone has a place in the world.
More about Jen Foster and her album The Underdogs at www.jenfoster.com.
The fifth album for Vermont native Gregory Douglas is called Stark.
A tragedy is the bottom of the mind's eye, but nobody replies or asks the right questions. It tells the right lies. Tragedy is the bottom of the mind's eye, and nobody really tries. And nothing's in motion. You think you do it all, but you're just in love with the boy from the dark side of town. 'Cause it's always around. It's just a matter of circumstance, not so wrong around. And sympathy is the bottom of the mind's eye.
The new album, Stark, is my fifth independent release, and it is a lot more stripped down than all the other records, hence the name Stark. I really wanted to get a lot more towards my roots, people that inspired me, and a lot more of an emotional, confrontational album in general.
You can learn more about the album Stark at www.gregorydouglass.com. And Douglas is D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S.
The latest album from pop duo Jason and DeMarco is called Till the End of Time.
I see it every day in me, a tendency to get so lost. That's why I need someone like you to bring me home. There is no doubt in my mind that God has brought to me an answer to pray. You're just in time to save my life, to share this moment to be by my side.
Their last album was called Spirit Pop, and Jason explains their new direction.
We're wanting to go in a direction of reaching even a broader audience. It's definitely more mainstream, leaning more towards a pop rock sound. We want to still have positive lyrics throughout the music, but it's more about real life. It's real life, real relationships, and then also bringing elements of spirituality into it.
Find out more about Jason and DeMarco's album, Till the End of Time, at www.jasonanddemarco.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas, 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Let it go. You don't have to understand. Just let me be who I am. My spirit can never be broken. I'm loaded with ammo, so you better put on your camo. I'm very outrageous. My sex is a little contagious, and you love it, you know it. So you better not blow it, 'cause you knew who I was for that, and I have no regrets for being this way. And you think that I won't compromise, but I'm tired of all the lies that I'm living each day. And I don't know who I am, but you wouldn't give a damn even if I did know. I just wanna live my life, and I know what's right for me, so just let it go. You don't have to understand, just let me be who I am. You don't have to agree, just let me be me. You don't have to compromise, just realize. You don't have to sing along, this is my self-there song. You don't have to understand, just let me be. I was when we met, and I have no regrets for being this way. And you think that I won't compromise, but I'm tired of all the lies that I'm living each day. And you think I don't know who I am, but you wouldn't give a damn even if I did know. I just wanna live my life, and I know what's right for me, so just let it go. You don't have to understand, just let me be who I am. You don't have to agree, just let me be me. You don't have to compromise, if just realize. You don't have to sing along, this is my self-best song. You don't have to understand, just let me be who I am. You don't have to agree, just let me be me. You don't have to compromise, just realize. You don't have to sing along, this is my self-best song. My self-best song.
This is JD, and that is a brand new artist from Dallas named Jeremy Henry. The song is called Selfish Song from his brand new CD, Bitterly Ever After You.
Oh. Unfortunately, we have to announce the passing of Jack Jackson, who was 81 years old, and Jack passed on Saturday. Jack has been a longtime community volunteer, activist, fundraiser, and just a general good person. And with us this evening is...
Ann Robinson.
And John Coulter.
And you all know Jack better than I did. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you met him, how Jack got involved in the Montrose Counseling Center.
I'm sure I met him at a fundraiser.
Of course. Where
no
else
other
do you meet
way.
People, right?
And, you know, for years and years, we did a fundraiser called Bringing in the Green, and Jack was our leprechaun. And his job as leprechaun was not only to entertain, but once you got in the door, you were required to pin $1, $5, whatever on him, and you'd get a sticker. And a lot of people tried various different ways to pin things on him and to embarrass him, and he cannot be embarrassed. My work with him, besides the fundraiser every year and his sponsorship, he paid as a sponsor and then he came and volunteered.
Right, yeah.
Was that I was, I'm ashamed to say, sometimes his costumer. I tell everybody that he was the designer. I just executed his designs. But there were many a time, Queen Nefertiti.
Oh, yeah,
and,
for the garden party.
And
he loved going to the garden party.
He was Marilyn Monroe one year, but did leather and lace, silk stocking,
mm-hmm.
ball in Galveston, the garden party, whatever opportunity. And he always said, I don't do drag. I'm in costume.
That's right. So. And he was that leprechaun every year that mm-hmm. Bringing in the Green was, well, I think, from the first one in 1988 to the last mm-hmm. one in 2005, he was there mm-hmm. as the leprechaun mm-hmm. with the South African accent.
Well, and Jack was from South Africa. Right. And
youngest of 10 children.
And he moved to the States in about the 50s.
Right. He moved to Houston sometime in the 50s. His brother-in-law was with Howard Hughes Brewery or something, and he moved here with them.
Okay.
And just fell in love with Houston and Texas and just stayed. He said he liked the friendliness, the open sky, and the wide open places.
Well, yeah.
And I guess there were more wide open places back then in Houston than there are now.
Exactly. And we understand that he probably got involved in the community during the early AIDS crisis.
Right. I mean, he had a brother that was mentally retarded and an epileptic. And so the idea of helping people was ingrained in him at an early age. And he always said his mother always told him that you are your brother's keeper, and it's something that he always remembered. And yes, that's when his volunteerism and activism really started here in Houston, was at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s.
What do you think drew him to the Montrose Counseling Center? I know he did many other things, but he seemed to have a special
right.
place for the counseling.
Well, I mean, he did volunteer for many organizations and was very active in EPA and did a lot of fundraising for that. I don't know. I think because we let him just do what he wanted. If he could be as campy as he wanted, he could I mean, outlandishly bizarre costumes as he wanted, and he liked doing that. He liked to be creative, and he was able to do that. And a lot of the people who went to that party were his friends. It was a lot of the EPA folks, but a lot of the senior people in the community, I guess, and there were a lot of his friends, and I think too, I'd like to think I had a special relationship with him, and he, I think, sometimes did it for me.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Because you guys were always going to the ballet and the symphony, and
well, that was his trade. I would make him a costume, and then his trade was I was his companion at Gilbert and Sullivan. He never, well, until this last year, he never missed the Gilbert and Sullivan opening night and the cast party. And for the last 12 years, I'd gone with him, but he did not make this last one, which was just a week before he died, I think.
Well, before, I don't know how long he's been retired. What did Jack do professionally?
He worked with a company that was down in the Clear Lake area, or maybe even further south than that, maybe Seabrook, way down between here and Galveston. And he worked for a company that dealt with shipping, and he coordinated the moving around of barges.
And it was, I think, there were oil tankers, mm-hmm. but his job was to get all the permits, make sure that on both ends the ship could leave port and go to port, and I think when he retired when the company mm-hmm. closed.
Right. It was a marine transportation company.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was the general manager.
And since then he has worked for Jeffrey Kuchar doing who's a realtor, doing putting up the notices at the houses, going around and make sure the houses were ready for open house and preparing all that and doing some office work there. And he did that a couple days a week and really enjoyed that because it kept him out.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, being 81 years old, it's a different generation that was not out, definitely.
Mm-hmm. No.
Different perception of the way the community is, and especially the community was much smaller. And mm-hmm. certainly we all know, 20 some years ago, how the community has grown. Mm-hmm. But we used to talk about, if there are five activists that we pass the hat around for a lot of organizations. And for Jack to come from that generation to be so involved mm-hmm. In the community.
And it was just a matter of fact to him, and it, he was involved in the gay community, he was involved in the HIV world. I asked his niece as we were holding vigil Friday night what his family thought about him being gay. And she said that his sister, who's 6 years older than him, wouldn't ever talk about it. But that the kids, when they were young, they knew that they kind of knew what was going on, but it was unspoken. And at one point, Jack had a fight with, or his sister's husband had a fight with him, and he wasn't allowed to go back to the house. And so the sister and the kids saw him when the father was away, or they came to his place where he worked to see him. And they always were told for years and years it was because Jack put ideas in their head about traveling. Jack, one of the things he loved to do was travel.
Mm-hmm. He sure did.
And
loved to go places.
And but his niece says she realizes now it was because he was gay. And I'm sure that was painful for him, but he never said anything about that, and never, he just kept going, and he remained.
He didn't let it bother him.
And he remained close to the nieces.
He did.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there were some special programs, since he knew the counseling center, and this is a perfect opportunity to talk about some of the wonderful things that the counseling center does do?
Well, I will tell you that when we started talking about doing senior services, Jack is the senior I've spent the most time with, and I saw how he was dealing with aging and his body not doing everything that it used to be able to do, and really that program, the SPY program, the senior program, was really designed because of Jack. Now Jack refused to use it. I sent outreach workers over to him three times, mm-hmm. and they said, now Ann says you have to do this, and he just went, pfft. So, but it was really that program, which is meant to be peer support and a sense of community and mental health services if they need them, and also help with daily living. But that was really pretty much designed to, in my mind, to honor Jack mm-hmm. and his generation.
God, it would have been perfect for him. Last couple
very
of months.
Stubborn. Very, yeah. Very stubborn.
Didn't want much to do with it, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, you sort of wonder, does volunteering help out longevity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting.
So.
There's a front page story in the New York mm-hmm. Times today talking about some people between 35 and 50, or somewhere around that area, being laid off from their work. You know, and mm-hmm. people who was either in a heavy industrial or a high powered job, that a lot of people are, since they can't find the same thing, they're just not going back to work, which mm-hmm. is putting strain on the family and et cetera. But a mindset of keeping busy all the time and doing stuff that's rewarding is certainly...
I think anything that keeps your mind active and gives you a sense of doing something positive in the world is good for your physical health and your mental health. And I think also for the people you talk about that get laid off... It is also an excellent way to make connections to find out about job opportunities. But you know, Jack stayed busy all
the
time.
He stayed busy as long as he could. When he, retired from the Marine Transportation Company, he didn't miss a beat, and it seemed like the next week he was working with Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. So he helped Jeffrey for, I'd say probably 12 or 13 years, you know, and kept busy just as long as he could.
And it's only been the last month or two he's really not felt well and not been active.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was a blessing. You know, I kept thinking Friday night, he helped so many people pass on with dignity and peace, and I hope we did that for him Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, if he went to Park Plaza Hospital and 12 Oaks to see HIV/AIDS patients once, he must have gone 1,000 times. He also, back in the late 80s, early 90s, thought it would be a great idea, since there were so many patients in the hospital, to have Thanksgiving dinner. And so he decided that it would be a great idea to have like a Thanksgiving buffet dinner, and he just organized it and set it up, got the people to help out, got food, I mean, did the whole thing, and it went on for several years, and he was there every year to shepherd it along and make sure that it happened. Mm-hmm. And the families and the patients really appreciated it.
Sure.
So And he was always very good about visiting people and checking with people, and you know, just you know, like his mother told him, you are your brother's keeper. And he, I think that was something that was ingrained in him and that he remembered his whole life.
And you know, he was recognized outside the gay community. He got the Mayor's Volunteerism Award. What year?
That was in 1990 from Mayor Kathy Whitmire.
And he was very proud of that. And he's gotten a lot of other awards from the Dianas, from our organization. He was from a Grand Marshal at the Pride Parade.
Yes, he was from 1991.
And, but it was really nice to see that the greater Houston community recognized his efforts, too. Because it was at a time when there was still some drama around HIV and, and particularly around being gay, too. But it was nice to see that he was recognized outside of that.
Yes, he was.
And we understand there's not going to be a service?
There will be a memorial service. Okay. We're working out the details now. So there'll be an announcement about that, and then probably within a week as far as when it will be. But yes, there'll be a memorial service.
And we know if anybody wants to make a contribution.
Well, I would. I don't want to play favorites with my agency,
right,
but I would say that I would. I think I could say with certainty that if somebody wanted to send something, he would prefer, instead of flowers, to make a donation to any one of the HIV or the gay organizations. I do know one thing he was talking about Friday night was to make sure he had started gathering up a number of articles and his awards that he's going to send to the archives. And so he was very concerned that that all be done because he wasn't sure his family would understand all of that.
Right.
So, but any of the organizations that he has worked with, I'm sure that would honor him.
Okay. Well, and we're talking about Jack Jackson, who is a longtime volunteer and just a great person, a real role model in this community, just passing away this past Friday at the age of 81. Certainly, he's received a lot of recognition in the community, but he's definitely a person to look up to. Ann and John, thank you very much for joining us tonight. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm gonna live my life like every day's the last, without a simple goodbye. It all goes by so fast. And now that you're gone, can't cry hard enough. No, I can't cry hard enough for you to hear me now. Gonna open my eyes and see for the first time. I've let go of you like a child letting go of his kite. There he goes up in the sky. There he goes beyond the clouds for no reason why. I can't. Back in vain, see you standing there when all that remains is just an empty chair. And now that you're gone, I can't cry hard. Can't cry hard enough for you to hear.
This is JD, and I hope you caught the words to that song, because I especially picked that song as a tribute to Jack Jackson. The song was Can't Cry Hard Enough by the Williams Brothers from their self-titled album from 1991. And coming up next is a short music set. You've heard about Lance Bass coming out? Well, another pop artist from England came out in the last month, Darren Hayes, who was half of the group Savage Garden. They sold about 23 million records. He came out and announced on his website that in the middle of June, he married his boyfriend of a couple years. From his 2002 album, Spin, here's the title track.
Government selected, nobody voted. Politically correct, isn't that a joke? your orders. And I know you got to watch your border. Yes, I know how I know, for I have been there too, and I live to tell. Yes, I know how I know, for I have built a wall and mended it well. They are marching one by one under a blazing sun, each with a smoking gun shining against the sky. They're marching two by two, marching on me and you. You and me, we
This is JD, and that happens to be a Queer Voices exclusive. And I know that because it's a song recorded live at the Houston Pride Festival by me in 2001, and it's never been released anywhere on record. Who did that? That was Dave Hall with the help of Marcus Hutchinson.
What did you think about the performers at Pride this year?
Well, I already knew some of them. I thought they were very good, especially Dylan Rice. Liked him a lot.
How could we improve it this year, this next year?
The committee does great. They start this process like in September or October. Amazingly, they start a lot earlier than a lot of other Pride fests across the country. And I've been alerting my artist friends, hey, if you want to play Houston, get your packages in early.
Well, the way they had the stages set up and all, it seemed to me that maybe they should separate them more.
The two stages?
Yeah.
I don't think, to me, that wasn't a problem. What I would have liked to have seen is the main stage moved forward 30, 40 feet to get it in the shade of those trees so that the people would be close to the stage. Because the people were not going to go in the sun and watch the performers.
No, not in that heat, no.
And I felt sorry for the performers because they kind of felt like people weren't paying attention.
Right.
And, I like to defend it. I'm on their side.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want them to have more of an audience. So
have you submitted that?
I ran it by one of the people, and he said, well, we were afraid of getting in the way of these wires, and maybe they'll consider it next year.
Yeah. What I'd like is for the bars down the street not to be playing anything.
Well, loud enough that you can hear out on the street. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, well, especially since a lot of their stuff was real offensive, but then you couldn't enjoy the artists that were in the actual festival. LSR here. I was wondering, are they having a Pride album release or anything like that?
Oh, I don't believe so. No. No.
I don't know that they've ever done anything like that.
No, I don't think they've ever done that.
They would have to really work out some things between the artists, and it would be kind of tricky.
And
a ton of releases, at least.
The other festivals that do Pride releases, it's not really the artists that are performing. It's usually circuit music.
Oh, I see.
Which,
oh, tragic.
Which to me is not gay music.
Right.
But that's a different soapbox.
Well, how did Team Houston do last week?
Well, you know, they just had the gay games in Chicago, and apparently the Houston folks did really well. They won 6 gold medals, 8 silvers, and 22 bronze. And some of them are leaving from there and going to the Out Games in Canada. So I guess that's
how far apart are those two events?
I think the Out Games must be this weekend.
There were, if I remember correctly, there were like a week apart.
They were close, I remember.
Yeah, really. And there was over 100 local athletes that you know, everything from bowling and tennis, and the Pride Man was up there. I think the Gay Men's Chorus also participated in the opening and closing ceremonies. We had some tennis winners,
I understood that there were going to be some protests at the game. Did it ever come off?
You know,
if there wasn't any news coverage on it, if there was,
I didn't hear about it that there was.
Well, some of those you know who were going to go up there and protest all the gays in one place playing.
Yeah. You know,
suffering from Phelpsitis,
something like that. Yes, yes.
Apparently,
someone similar, if not him.
About 30 of the Team Houston members were going on to the Out Games, and about 100. There were 100 athletes from Houston that took part in the Gay Games, and there's gymnastics, and I think they have a few different events at there. At that, but apparently in
like high heel drag racing.
Yeah, well, you know, they do that in Washington D.C. They do a drag race on Halloween, and that's exactly what it is. They run in high heels.
And how do you contact the people about entering? I'd love to try that one.
I bet you could do well. Not me. I'm not even walking in the darn high heels, much less trying to run in them.
Well, I grew up in those.
Yeah, well.
Of course, I was using my mom's. I'd sneak in there.
Yeah. Well, we had quite a great show tonight with the folks from Baring and Friends joining us.
We're talking live music. That's a treat for us.
Yes,
it was.
Is.
It was good, too.
And that's, again, going to be at the Alley on the 11th and 12th of August in the Niehaus stage. And www.baringandfriends.com. Was it .com or .org?
Don't know.
Well, try one.
Try one or the other.
Right. And then we had Sam Gutierrez talking with Greg Chapman and Jennifer about ways to get more in touch with yourself and how to...
Wait a second. Don't say it quite that way.
In touch with your feelings.
Our feelings.
Okay,
in touch with
I
our
stand
feelings.
Corrected.
Moving right along.
And then, of course, we want to honor the passing of Jack Jackson, great friend of the community and activist, and it was nice that we could have the folks from the Counseling Center come on and talk
that's
about
a very fitting tribute.
What's on for next week?
Next week. What the heck do we have for next week? Special. Something special.
Something special. We got David Elliott from Washington, D.C. on Inside the Beltway and Beyond Report. And then we've got Allison Bechtel, an artist and writer of the Dykes to Watch Out For.
Sounds interesting. She's been writing that for many years.
She's an icon.
Yes. And she's going to be interviewed by Pokey Anderson. And
who's an icon in her own way.
Yes. That's true. But what's interesting is she has written a memoir called Fun Home, and it's about her experience growing up with a closeted gay father.
And then Joan Devlin's going to be here with Gay Marriage, For Better or For Worse. And, of course, as always, this is Jennifer Renee.
J.D. Doyle.
Deborah Bell. And
Elisar Saliba.
And we're Queer Voices.
Join us next week.
What was the big hurry?
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
KPFT's fall concert series is coming up this September and October, and we are looking for musicians to fill spots in six different genres.
The genres are world music, Zydeco Cajun, Roots Americana, Indie Rock, Turntables to Turntablas, and Hip Hop.
So if you are a civic-minded artist looking for local exposure, this is your opportunity. Send a copy of your original music on a CD along with the photo, bio, and any other information you would like us to have to www.kpft.org.
Please note that no artist will benefit financially from this event. The concert series is free to all who attend.
Again, those genres are world music, Zydeco Cajun, Roots Americana, Indie Rock, Turntables to Turntablas, and Hip Hop.
Visit www.kpft.org for more information.
And help KPFT encompass Houston's multicultural, multigenerational, and musical diversity.
This is KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
This is 90.1 KPFT. Don't miss the 17th Annual Houston Press Music Awards Showcase on Sunday, July 30th, starting at 4 p.m. in downtown Houston. Sample the sounds of over 60 local bands and surrounding Main Street venues. And don't forget to let your voice be heard on this year's Houston Press Music Awards ballot. You become the critic. Cast your vote by Sunday, July 30th. Ballots are available in this week's Houston Press and at HoustonPress.com. The results will be published in the August 3rd issue of Houston Press. Wristbands for the showcase and special discounts are available at participating locations. The Houston Press Music Awards is brought to you in part by KPFT. Pick up this week's Houston Press, log on to HoustonPress.com or call 713-280-2448 for more information. This is 90.1 KPFT.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.